Well, good morning. My name is Charlie McConis, and I'm here with you on the teaching staff at Holden Village to present a five-part presentation on the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible. And today's class will be an introductory class giving you some initial understanding of apocalyptic literature, and then in particular the approach to the book of Revelations that I will be taking in this class. I will teach the class so that one can either enjoy an individual segment or, if you wish, spend 5 days with me going through the entire book. At Holden, we don't talk a great deal about people's credentials. At the same point in time, when I sit down to listen to somebody, I always want to know a little bit of why I should stay awake. So I'll give you just a little bit. I am not, first and foremost, a formal biblical scholar in the sense of an exegete. I am a much more general theologian, and my particular expertise in training has more to do with social ethics, the social implications of the Christian gospel message. However, I do believe that the book of Revelations is an important faith source for precisely those questions. And that's why I have chosen that book to explore. It's also, as you know, a difficult topic and one that one doesn't come across very often, and it seemed to me that Holden here, with our relaxed atmosphere and our time to be away from everyday concerns, is a good place and a time to tackle what might otherwise be too troubling or difficult an exercise in theology. A little bit more about my own background. I am 39 years old, married, and have a lovely year-old daughter. My wife and child will be joining me here next weekend. I teach part-time at the University of Puget Sound in religion. I am Roman Catholic by religious heritage and functioned as a priest for 7 years before returning to the lay state with the permission of the Vatican. I have been long involved in matters of peace and justice from a Christian faith standpoint. And as I will talk about later, those activities have convinced me that we are in for some hard times in this country with regard to possible conflicts between church and state. But to the topic at hand, the book of Revelations. As I'm sure you're aware, the two most common reactions to the last book of the Bible, for anyone who has attempted even to read it, are, first of all, either to ignore it, since it's impossible to understand anyway. And for many years, I would say that that was my reaction to that book. So if it's been yours, welcome to the crowd. There is a very prominent second reaction, which I think is undergoing something of a revival today, and that is to interpret the last book of the Bible as an exact blueprint for world history in our time, more or less of a fundamentalist approach in which one believes that one can look at the book of Revelations and that it accurately predicts with precise historical detail what will soon happen in our world here and now. I won't go into it in great detail at this point, but obviously I disagree with the first point or I wouldn't be teaching a class. I do think it is possible to derive an important level of meaning and understanding of the book of Revelation. Not easy, but possible. Secondly, I am not, in my own biblical understanding and belief, a fundamentalist, and I believe that interpretation of the book of Revelations is not correct. That if to ignore it is to slough off on one side, then to interpret it exactly literally is to go too far on the other. and that the best way to understand and appreciate this amazing book is, of course, somewhere in the middle course. If one is to understand the book of Revelation, then you have to understand the basic type of biblical writing that it is representative of. And that, of course, is what is known as apocalyptic writing. That's a big word. Apocalyptic is from the Greek, and it means unveiling, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. It seems clear that this kind of biblical writing is an outgrowth or development of the writing of the prophets in the Old Testament. So the roots of the very last book of the Bible go back to some of the very earliest writings. There is a continuity that one can discover, and we'll be looking into that. When I say an outgrowth or development, I mean that apocalyptic writing begins with prophetic roots, but carries that development further in certain directions. And I'd like to go down and give you a list, a comparison of styles of prophetic writing, or rather points that are very obvious in prophetic writing, and how apocalyptic developed that or changed it, certainly in Old Testament times. For example, as you are aware in your reading of the prophets were people of action who engaged in a great deal of spontaneous and eloquent preaching. They were, to use the modern term, activists. They were not primarily educators or writers as a group. The apocalyptists, on the other hand, were people of the written word who communicated with very deliberate and studied effect. So, in other words, when you read the prophets, very often what you are reading is the recorded recollections of disciples hearing a prophet giving one of the greatest, you know, fire and brimstone sermons you ever heard, whereas the apocalyptic writings are more often like a theological essay in a scholarly journal, and one must understand that difference. The prophets, again, as you will recall, were people who were involved in the very convoluted and difficult politics of Palestine itself. And they judged individual events, whether or not the people were cleaving to true worship of Yahweh, whether or not the poor and widows were being taken care of. And they crusaded for God's rule in the land of Israel. You know, come back to Yahweh, people of Israel, of course, is the classic cry in the prophets. The apocalyptists, on the other hand, reached out to a cosmic mission. They thought this whole matter goes way beyond just the people of Israel and what's going on in the Davidic kingdom in Israel. And they developed a religious explanation of universal history of the whole world, the world's future. And they really envisioned Yahweh ruling over the whole world, not just the people of Israel. And of course, that's something that we find very understandable and familiar today, because we certainly have a much better understanding of the whole globe than people did 2,000 or even 4,000 years ago. Thirdly, the prophets were blunt speakers about religious abuses, social and political abuses going on, and they were seldom misunderstood. Right, they got in a lot of trouble very quickly. You know, when they said, you know, the government stinks because we're not doing God's will, wham, in the slammer they went. Or the well, or, you know, all the various places that happened to the prophets. Apocalyptists, on the other hand, they wrote very symbolically about visions that they did not fully understand. And here again, I'm sure you agree that their audience found even more difficult to understand. And that, of course, again, is part of the word apocalyptic. And so it's easy to say that symbolism is the most characteristic trait of apocalyptic writing. And of course, that presents a problem, because As we all know, a symbol can mean one thing to one person and another thing to another, and that is obviously part of the difficulty of understanding apocalyptic writing, and it will be part of the difficulty of understanding the book of Revelations. Well, why all this symbolism? I mean, were all these apocalyptists, were they just drunk on words, or were they frustrated poets, or what? No, they were very clearly indicating something very important, namely the transcendence of God's truth. It's very important to say that God's truth is very obvious and very clear, and that it touches our daily lives. And we call that the imminence of God's presence in our lives, right? The prophets were very strong on that. The apocalyptists were much stronger on emphasizing the fact that God is other. He is beyond our understanding. She is beyond our understanding. We cannot nail God down with a good definition. And when one is suggesting that, then symbolism is a very good way of making that point. That you will notice in apocalyptic writing, all of it, especially in the book of Revelations, you know, you're really, the Spirit does reveal this. Doesn't happen normally. You know, God sort of invades the person very, very directly, and angels are constantly coming down, even explaining to the author what was meant by that vision. They can't figure it out all the time. And often the visions are delivered in very amazing places. The author is carried out to the desert to hear the word, or, and this is an appropriate thing to think about here at Holden, up on a mountaintop. Mountaintops are very frequent locales for apocalyptic visions. That was, if you saw the excellent slide show on the trails of Holden yesterday, that point was not made in there. Watch out, you go hiking up there, anything can happen. You may just get yourself some visions. Those mountaintops are very frequent locations. So those are some of the points. There is a different notion of history between the prophets and apocalyptic writers also. Aside from the fact that the prophetic writers are more interested in the politics and history of Israel itself, the prophetic writers generally saw the present sorrowful moment leading to a future victory for the elect in the land of Israel. And the apocalyptists carried that to an extreme. They would see this affecting the whole world and the heavens opening and the future of the whole world crashing into the present through God's action. It's, I think, of the essence of apocalyptic writing that the view of history is that only God's direct action can transform the world. You know, very much, again, emphasizing God's transcendence, that God invades, if you will, intervenes, that the whole situation is in such a mess, that's what it will take. These are themes that are apparent in other books of the Bible, particularly the writings of the prophet Ezekiel and also the book of Daniel. So if you want to check some of these points out that I've been making, those are two very prominent Old Testament apocalyptic works. And there are also little tiny chunks of apocalyptic writing in the New Testament, too. Matthew 25 would be a good example. Well, this sort of writing and believing and movement in among the Jewish people continued to develop even after the birth of Christ and reached an extreme shortly after Christ's death and resurrection in the first century, and resulted in a belief on the part of some elements of the Jewish people that they should act in a revolutionary manner in order to help bring in God's kingdom, the transformation of the world, to throw out the Romans. And as a result, twice in the years of 60 to 66 AD and then 132 to 135, the people, the Jewish, primarily the Jewish people of Palestine, rebelled against the Roman Empire, which of course was occupying Palestine at that time. Both revolts ended in terrible disaster and defeat for the Jewish people. Tremendous amount of despair. Really, another expulsion from the land of Palestine. And as a result, for many years thereafter, much of the Jewish community gave up its hope in the coming of a Messiah or the arrival of God's kingdom, and instead emphasized the very careful practice of the law again as the most appropriate way to follow God's will. However, apocalyptic did not die with those Jewish defeats in those two revolutions. The Christian community also found this style of writing to be useful, and the book of Revelations is the quintessential example of that, because, of course, the Christian community found that God's triumph through Jesus' resurrection was the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, and that Christ's second coming was the ultimate fulfillment of them. And what might have died out with the death of the Jewish revolutionary element instead found a home in the early Christian community of the first century. So you have, in other words, the book of Revelations, or the Apocalypse of John, as it's also called, is a book that is very reminiscent of some Old Testament literature and contains many citations of Old Testament literature, because in some ways it continues very clearly a form of writing that was prevalent there. And it's very helpful to understand that. In other words, you will do a lot better ultimately understanding that book of the Bible if you also take a crack at reading Ezekiel and the book of Daniel. Incidentally, I will eventually clam up here and take questions and all of that. Let's go through. If we start taking questions in the middle, we'll probably run out of time, and I can get more disciplined this way. Okay, well, now to look at the book of Revelation, we've talked now about the whole notion of what kind of biblical writing in general is that book. It's a form of apocalyptic writing. And indeed, Revelations, if you look at it, is a classical example of that. And the author, as do almost all apocalyptic writers, presents himself as part of a group that's being persecuted for its faith. That becomes very clear very early on in the book of Revelation. And the book is quite clearly written, I believe, with a purpose, namely to strengthen the community that was undergoing this persecution by explaining to them the meaning of it and the fact that they're enduring suffering now for the faith, but there will be victory, that the faith will endure, and that ultimately Christ is triumphant, in not only in our own lives, not only in our own community, not only in our own nation, but even in the world, in our hopes for it. At the most obvious level, the persecution and the suffering is occurring because of a conflict that was going on then between church and state, to be precise, the Roman Empire. But John makes it quite clear that there's a deep, that's on level one, but there's a deeper level of that conflict, and that conflict ultimately really is between God and Satan, as we all know very well, and that the church community represents Christ's community struggling with the powers of evil as embodied or represented by, or in some way occupied by, the imperial state. But that there will be a final victory of Christ over Satan and of the church over the state, and an entirely new world created by God will be inaugurated. Terribly important message for a very troubled, suffering people to hear. We'll get back to this in a bit. A few other P's and Q's about the origins of the book. Like I say, I'm not an exegete. I'm relying on other people for this basic information. And if you want to do more strictly exegetical work, I can help you on that. There are very fine reference works available here in the library of Holden. Who wrote the book of Revelation? I'm sure you're thinking about that. The author's name is obvious, John, right? And it's quite clear that that is a real name of a real person, not a fake name. The earliest traditions are that the John who wrote Revelation or Apocalypse is the same as John the Apostle who wrote the fourth gospel and several epistles. Beginning in the third century, there began to be some dissent among various Christian believers and scholars about that belief, based on what's known in these circles as internal evidence. For example, the author of the fourth gospel wrote excellent Greek, very beautiful, classy, poetic Greek. And whoever wrote the book of Revelations was, you know, had just got off the boat and was learning, was not very fluent, was not a very good writer. That's just to give you an example. And so that's cited as one piece of evidence that the same author that wrote the fourth gospel did not himself write the book of Revelation. This is a very involved dispute, and I don't think that it bears a great deal on our ability to understand the book of Revelations. It's quite clear that if it wasn't John the Apostle himself, that it was a very prominent disciple in the community of the early first century, perhaps a close follower of John the Apostle. It's possible that John the Apostle dictated things to a scribe who just didn't know Greek very well. No one really, there is dispute. And whichever position you take, there are fine authorities who will back you on that. So I can only leave you with dignified confusion as to the exact author of that book. And all positions appear to me to be tenable on the matter. More importantly, I think, for the understanding and interpretation that I will be giving, there is also dispute about the exact time when the book was written. Again, there are some internal questions and problems. But almost everyone is agreed. There's a minority that doesn't agree with this, but the vast majority agree that the book was obviously written during an actual persecution of the early Christian community, which would place it sometime in the first century. And that the most likely time, given some of the evidence in there, was that it was at least put together in final form during the persecution under the Emperor Domitian in the years 90 to 96. Domitian's persecution was a very wide-ranging one over all of Asia Minor. We've all heard of Nero, right? And he fiddled while Rome burned and accused the Christians. Nero's was one of the first persecutions, but it really didn't extend much beyond the area of Rome. But the key thing to understanding why most scholars say this book was written during the persecution of Domitian is that the book of Revelations makes numerous references to the fact that the Roman Empire of that time insisted that he himself be worshipped as God, and that this had to be done formally, and that even some sort of mark had to be borne by people indicating that. And we do know very solidly that the Emperor Domitian, towards the end of his reign, indeed did demand that he himself be worshipped as God. And on the coins, he was called Dominus et Deus Noster, our Lord and our God. Very, you know, you could not come up with a clearer case of idolatry than that, as far as the early Christian community was concerned. So that, it appears to me, was the setting for this book. The early Christian community was undergoing fierce persecution under the Roman Emperor Domitian for, among many other things, refusing to engage in emperor worship. I will be offering an interpretation of the book of Revelation that stresses that last fact very much, that this was a book written under a time of persecution, of conflict between the church and state. I will precisely in this class be offering an interpretation that I learned from one of my mentors, the Catholic Jesuit priest Father Daniel Berrigan, a theologian and poet and peace activist. And I will be taking a significant amount of my material from a recent book of his called The Nightmare of God. There are copies of the book available at the bookstore here in Holden. It's published by a friend of mine who runs a small press in Oregon called Sunburst Press. If you think that this sounds like a class that you really want to dig into for all five sessions, then I certainly advise you to buy the book. It's a paperback and only $6. And it will help you considerably if you're going to go through all five. If you've decided that you don't want to, I would ask you that you not purchase this book here so that others who want to engage in the full study can. This is prominently on display in a table in the bookstore, this bright red book called The Nightmare of God by Daniel Berrigan.
I'm going to be here today and tomorrow. But I could go on then with the use of that book to go on with to this and
sure.
Follow.
Exactly. Very definitely. Right. Yes. Berrigan is somewhat easier to read than John of the Apocalypse.
Okay.
Not a whole lot, but but somewhat. And Dan's interpretation of this book is, and this is to repeat somewhat, but to be very clear, that the book of Revelation is a very dislocating book about a bad time in the history of the church. And that's one of the things that makes it hard to read. It was written under a lot of conflict and a lot of turmoil. And he asks, is it also in some way about our time? Now remember, I've already said that that I do not agree, I respectfully do not agree with those who interpret the book of Revelations as an exact blueprint for what's going to happen, that you can look and say, well, the beast from the sea, that's Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, and Gog is the commies in Iran, and I don't believe in that approach. I'm not going to mock people who do, but I don't believe in that. But, on the other hand, Berrigan asks, is in some way this book about our time? Is it relevant for our time? And, of course, he believes very much that it is, and so do I. Berrigan says, in summary, in his book about the book of Revelations, that Revelations offers us an historic instance of one believing community combating for its very soul with the imperial state. Of course, the Christians and the Romans. And the book, Dan says, then really says to us, judge your own time. Here's how we were faithful these many years ago in this circumstance, and maybe our experience will help you. So, for Dan Berrigan and for me, the book of Revelation is a very challenging and important book because it asks more or less the following question. Is ours a time and place of mortal conflict between the church and the state? And if you answer yes to that, then how should we believers conduct ourselves in such a time? Now, obviously, we're not living in the first century under Rome, and the circumstances are quite different. One might easily point to occasions in recent history that were not so different. A classic example would, of course, be Hitler's Germany. And one can point to even current circumstances that where one could make a great case that that is the case. Certain areas of totalitarian domination, obviously communist, certainly in some of the countries under communist control. Another very pertinent contemporary example is the situation in South Africa of institutionalized racism. All of the ones that I've just cited, however, are easy for you and I. I presume that most of us here are Americans. If there's someone who isn't, welcome to the class, and we'll talk about that too. But the much harder question for us is to ask that question of our own time and our own place, the country in which you and I were born and raised, and which, and I want to make it very clear, we all deeply love. Two generations ago, the McConuses were dirt farmers in Lithuania. So we've done pretty well in this country, and we deeply love it. But that doesn't answer the question. Now, what I have for you to chew on, this is, you know, sort of the opening question of the class, in other words. Revelation is a book about the Christians versus the state in a mortal conflict for the very soul of the church. Is ours a time and place where that's the case? I'm sure you can guess, if you know anything about the life of Daniel Berrigan, that his answer to that, there's no great mystery, is yes. And that's also my answer. No point in covering that notion up. But I don't expect that you have to or want to or will eventually agree with me on that. But I want to raise it as a very provocative question in this class. And as an initial resource, in addition to obviously your Bible with the book of Revelations, and if you so choose, Dan Berrigan's book, I do have a photocopied article for all of you from the current issue of the Christian Century by the theologian Robert McAfee Brown. And the article is an adapted version of a speech I heard him give this spring at a very important conference that took place near here in Seattle. And the conference was to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Declaration of Barmen, which was the confessing church taking a stand against Hitler's Nazi Germany in 1934. And in essence saying, you know, to obey this state is to engage in idolatry. And McAfee Brown asks the same question we're asking in the course here with the help of the Book of Revelations and Dan Berrigan. In some way, is ours a similar time? You know, 1984 and George Orwell and all that. Is 1984 really here, where you and I live? And the obvious first reaction we all have to that, including myself, is, well, of course not. I mean, any fool can see that. Here you and I all sit publicly in the open, free as birds, openly discussing this matter. There isn't any one of us, I don't think, except maybe me, because I'm paranoid, sitting here thinking, well, now, who's the informer in here that's going to turn us in so that when the boat lands at Fields Point, they're all going to lock us up? Well, you and I know that's not going to happen. So let's all agree that the first obvious answer to that question is that no, you can't remotely compare our time and place with Hitler's Germany or South Africa today, or certainly the church under the Roman Empire. But I'm suggesting that that first reaction may not be an adequate one. And if the subject interests you, then please, on your way out, be sure to pick up a copy of McAfee Brown's article here. If you are going to continue with this five-part presentation, then there are going to be schedules of readings for the next class, in addition to the brief three-page article by Robert McAfee Brown. I would ask that you read with some, you know, deliberation the first five chapters of the Book of Revelations, the first five chapters for tomorrow. And if you choose to purchase the Berrigan book, which I will be referring to quite often, the first 35 pages of that book. So if you want to get, you know, disciplined about this, that's what you should read. The Brown article, the first five chapters of the Book of Revelations, and 35 pages here. The whole thing comes to not all that much reading, really. And there'll be less of it as time goes by. That's my introduction to the book and to the class. I want to say in particular that I am here as a guest at Holden to be available to the community and to you to talk about these things. And as you've already guessed, I love to talk. So please feel free to buttonhole me anywhere you see me wandering around. If you say, now, you know, a question just occurred to me. A lot of times I won't know the answer, but I'll tell you where you can find it out. I'll be easily recognizable often. I walk around wearing my Detroit Tigers baseball hat. I've always been a Detroit Tigers fan since I was 8 years old. I didn't just start rooting for them this year because all of a sudden they're successful. In 1975, they won 58 games and lost 102, and I rooted for them then. So, please feel free to call on me wherever you find me. I am living in chalet number 1 in room 3 if you need to get some message to me that way. Thank you for listening so patiently. Now, I would like to open it up for any questions you might have about the nature of the course or where we might go with it or about today's presentation in particular.
I take it that you're being taped and that tapes would be available if we're not able to attend all the classes?
That's correct. Every session, it's my understanding that every session here at Holden of the teaching sessions is taped. And we'll eventually be available both in the tape library, which is located right down the hallway here, and eventually also for sale through the bookstore here. It's a wonderful service offered by the community. I was just looking, for example, a very great Christian woman whom I got to know and love very deeply, Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, who died this spring of cancer, and her tapes are available, a couple of them, of presentations that she gave here. You know, now what a treasure it is to have her words. On that, while that thought crosses my mind, some evening this week, I forget, I saw the schedule, I've forgotten now, they will be showing a film about her, and in particular about one of the last great moments of her life when she joined her son and also, as it happens, yours truly, in a boat going out trying to stop the arrival of a nuclear submarine.
You were in that boat?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you'll find that film very, very interesting, and I'll be part of the discussion around that film. Yes?
I live in Ellensburg, and I was truly surprised that there was hardly anything in the newspapers or on television about this conference. Our campus minister associate went to it, and we learned some things from him, but I kept looking at the PI, and I kept watching television. There was nothing about this conference.
About the Barman conference?
Yes, and yeah. It was... Really, we talked about it. It was very important.
Yes, it was. I think it was an extremely historic conference. Apparently, they had a serious failure in public relations there. I can say that because I had nothing to do with it. But
serious something.
Yes, that's a shame. It was an amazing event. There were scholars like Eberhard Bethge, who of course wrote the definitive biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And on up to people making the connections for us today, the great German woman theologian Dorothee Zola, for instance.
Was well, some of the actual people that lived in the village that made the stand against Hitler.
Yes.
And said, we will not do this.
That's right. It was a very powerful experience. So at least you'll get a little bit of it here through McAfee Brown's presentation. Yes, sir.
I'm very much interested in the poetry that you find in the Book of Revelation.
Yes.
And it seems as though either they picked up the liturgy of the church or it's become the liturgy of the church. Yeah. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, it seems quite clear that large portions of the Book of Revelation relate in some way to the early liturgy of the church. If they aren't direct, you know, transpositions, they certainly are reminiscent of that. And it has thus been suggested that the book really originally was very much meant to be read out loud and meant to be read at worship services. I think, as you well know, that with all translations, you know, it's hard to get a good translation of poetry. I would love to hear somebody attempt to read the Book of Revelations in the original languages to just to hear the music of it in that original tongue. But it's beautiful enough as is. You're quite right. And the whole notion of worship, both as a style of language and as event in the Book of Revelations, is very important, because you know, one might think in a bad time like that, you kind of wouldn't be able to put a lot of time and energy into liturgy, right? Where you're under persecution and all this kind of stuff, and of course, exactly the opposite becomes true, that liturgy and worship becomes, you know, the very source of strength to endure in a time like that. And that's why that sort of experience is so prevalent in the Book of Revelations. That, you know, at a point in time when you might think that activism is most called for, also worship and contemplation is most called for. Yes?
Maybe I misunderstood you. I think you said two things that I'd like to ask you how you relate them. One, you said that you didn't agree with, say, fundamentalist idea of kind of a schedule of events that would that are kind of blueprinted here. And the other thing that you said, which seems to be a little not quite in keeping with that, is a quite a great distinction between the advent of Christ in the flesh, in his death and resurrection, and I forget how you put it, his consummation and his so-called second coming.
Yes.
You see that?
Yes.
Because then you've got a little space in between. How do you relate the two? Maybe this is the rest of the course in my...
Well, no, it, of course, it, certainly it is one of the great dilemmas that has to do with New Testament apocalyptic. The whole eschatological question about the second coming of Christ. Clearly, the early community saw the resurrection as a great triumph and as the inauguration of God's kingdom, and that's very obvious, for instance, in John's gospel, that the kingdom is here, and the kingdom is now, and the kingdom is already being fulfilled. And yet it did not take the early Christians very long to realize that the world was not transformed entirely in the way one would wish, and that Christ's promise that he will come again became increasingly important to the early community. And the Book of Revelation, of course, stresses the fact that Christ indeed will come again and usher in the great final victory over Satan in the eschatological struggle at the end of time. And the controversy that relates about a fundamentalist interpretation of Revelations could also be called the millenarian problem, which is that time and time again, Christian communities down through the ages have tried to find in the last book of the Bible a precise historical prediction about the nature of Christ's second coming and final victory, that one can read out of or into the Book of Revelations a guide whereby you can take that book and get your calendar out and find out when the final battle is going to be and where and when Christ will return. That's an interpretation that I find untenable, that one is able to find in the Book of Revelations that sort of a precise prediction about what is clearly a religious and theological event. Certainly the mainstream body of theology points out that Christ is already here and not yet fully here, and that the important point for us as Christians is that the urgency is always with us. That for all we know, the end is indeed near. Maybe even at the gates. Maybe one can look at our time and say, boy, oh boy, you better get here soon. I think that's been a very common Christian response to that book, and I think it should be ours, that there is a very strong message of urgency, that ours is a time near and even where this struggle is beginning, and that we should all of us live with the realization that Christ will come in victory, and will come, if you want to put it in quotes, soon. But I think it's a very grave mistake to try and tack an historical calendar date down to that, or to try and tack certain other political or historical information precisely into some of the other symbolic imagery of the Book of Revelations. This has occurred time and again down through history in various millenarian movements in the church, and I think that we're seeing a bit of that again in our time, in which one interpretation, for instance, which I disagree with, is that the world, if you'll pardon my language, is clearly going to hell in a handbasket now, and it's all going to obviously end in a nuclear war soon, and Jesus is going to come in on the mushroom clouds. And that will be, you know, and that's clearly, one is clearly able to demonstrate that, taking the apocalyptic texts and certain newspaper articles. I don't think that that's not my interpretation of the Book of Revelations, and I don't agree with that. But that's not to say that precisely some of the same issues that the world is in very grave trouble and that the nuclear question is one of them is a very important consideration as we read this book. As you'll see, I feel very strongly that that is the case. But again, to make that distinction between taking this matter seriously and literally is, I think, a crucial one in regard to an understanding and appreciation of the Book of Revelation.
Can I ask a question just to follow up on that?
Okay, just to follow up, Charlotte. Right,
excuse me. If you say that, in a sense, Christ has already come, and then not yet, the first part of it would mean, in a sense, that history has ended in the death and resurrection.
Yes. I think that that has been one theme in Christian theology, and it's in which the kingdom of God is embodied in some way, shape, or form in the church. And that there's an element of truth to that understanding, that in some sense the kingdom of God is indeed already present in the belief.
But then you have tension with the opposite. That
exactly. Right. But obviously, not entirely. You know, I mean, maybe someday if the whole world's a Holden Village, we'll be there. Your question, yeah.
I wondered about the soon part that you said.
Yes.
Couldn't that be 1,000 years or 2,000 years yet?
Sure, of course.
I was wondering about that.
That's precisely the case. I think that one must not understand that soon necessarily in the literal notion that we had all better take out our calendars.
And it means tomorrow or the next day.
Right, and you know, reserve next February because that's when it's going to happen. But at the same point in time...
It might.
It might. And of course, what has always been made quite clear to, for us as Christian believers, that for any, certainly, obviously, for all of us as individuals, that our own life may come to an end at any point in time, and that we may not be able to be around here for the second coming. So that on an individual sense, certainly we must always live in that anticipation, but I think also in the wider societal sense, that the Christian community is a community that lives in hopeful expectation of the coming of Christ, because we realize that for all of our efforts, I mean, I don't care how advanced Holden Village ever gets, it's not going to bring in the kingdom, right? Finally, only the Lord brings it in.
Well, teacher, don't you think that Christ, you say, is here, he's above us, he is in us.
Very definitely. Sure.
And Jesus has a mind of you.
There's no question about that. That's the way in which the kingdom is already present. And a place like Holden is a paramount example of that. So there's absolutely no question about my belief, or the Book of Revelation's belief, too. The Book of Revelation is not saying that Jesus is not present in the suffering community. saying that Jesus is indeed very present. It's hard to think of a part of the life of the community in which Jesus is not more present in the suffering of martyrs than in the suffering of martyrs,
he
for instance.
These people through their trials.
Exactly.
Baby family,
exactly.
He is still with them to the very end.
That is the point that is made most strongly in this book, that no matter what you're going through, I am with you. I think Elmer Witt presented that very beautifully in his sermon last night. And yet, we all find ourselves in very scary circumstances and need to be bolstered up. I have found that the book of Revelations is much easier to understand when one finds oneself in circumstances where you've gotten into trouble because of your Christian belief. Then all of a sudden, certain parts of the book that you used to think were just kind of screwy, all of a sudden feel very good.
Mean a lot.
Mean a lot.
Right.
Exactly.
I like that.
I think this is one of the important points I'll be making as we go through the course. A lot of scripture scholarship has to do, and I did some of that with you today, with trying to understand the circumstances in which the book was written and things like that. And I think of equal importance, and certainly Holden is a good example of this, is what are the circumstances in which the book is being read today? By whom? And what's happening to us? And what are we doing? Is not sometimes our problem in understanding Scripture the fact that our lives are so confused and murked up that we can't get through to it? And if a little few different things happen in our lives, then certain passages light up that didn't used to mean much to us. I'm sure we've all had experiences like that, where a passage that we read time and time again and thought, well, that's nice. And then what? Your mother dies, and you remember that she used to read that passage to you, and all of a sudden, it's an entirely new passage, isn't it? With an entirely new meaning.